The U.S. Supreme Court has invalidated President Trump's use of the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977 to implement his tariffs. What does the court's ruling mean, and what's next for tariffs and for presidential powers more generally? That's what I'd like to know. We're going to find out on this episode of Independent Conversations. Hi, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you from Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And I am very pleased to be able to discuss this case with my colleague, Dr. Philip Magnus, who holds the David J. Thoreau Chair in Political Economy here at Independent. Phil, I'm glad to have you on because you're one of a handful of people who actually got the ball rolling on this case. And I want to ask you a little later about how you did that. But first, let's address the decision itself. I haven't read this as carefully as you have, Phil, I'm sure, but I didn't really see much discussion in the decision about the emergency part of the IEEPA thing. There didn't seem to be any agreement or statement by the justices in a clear way whether there was or wasn't an emergency. Did I miss something?
No, I think that's accurate. They fairly conspicuously avoided addressing that question. And I think they did so because they didn't really need to address it. Rather, they focused on a couple of different constitutional doctrines and statutory doctrines, basically asking the question, does IEEPA even authorize President Trump or any president to impose tariffs as a tool? And the Supreme Court majority ruled quite clearly that no, it doesn't. They recognized what we knew at the very beginning of this case, that IEEPA does not even include the word tariff in the statute. And therefore, it follows from that that you cannot infer that word into the text from its vagaries. You can't write it into the penumbra of IEEPA, to put it, to use a term that sometimes has appeared around the Supreme Court. So instead, they basically noted just as basic constitutional law, the power to tariff comes from the power to assess taxes in a certain type of tax, the impost, which is in Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution belonging to Congress.
Well, but wait a minute. The president's in charge of foreign affairs, and if he wants to make those foreign nations pay us money, why can't he make them pay us money, Phil?
Well, there's the thing, because the regulatory power over commerce also falls in Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution. It, too, belongs to Congress. The president does have prerogative in negotiation in foreign affairs, and he has prerogative in certain military actions to execute the laws of Congress. But these are all fundamentally derivative powers that come from Congress's legislative priority.
So Congress has constitutional authority over the imposition of tariffs, unless it has explicitly and clearly delegated some element of that power to the president. So I think, if I'm understanding this right, the majority of the court, six members, said that Congress did not so delegate its power.
That is indeed correct. And you know, we know from the long history of tariffs, they're the very first tax system of the United States. The first tariff dates back to 1789, and it was intended at the Constitutional Convention to fund the government. And it used to be the case for well over a century after that, Congress would meet on a regular basis, and they'd go through line by line and legislate the tariff rate on steel, on iron, on glass, on machine parts, you name it. And these are incredibly long, complex bills. Well, in the early 20th century, they got into some trouble with the Smoot-Hawley Act, kind of backfired.
More than a little trouble.
A little bit of trouble. It's at the outset of the Great Depression, and it just throws the world into trade turmoil by worsening the economic conditions it was intended to try to mitigate for the United States. So it backfires. And what happened is Congress started to delegate away prerogative in negotiating away trade barriers. And that begins really in, so 1934 is the first negotiation authorization that's explicit. This is our retreat from Smoot-Hawley. But there were a few other clauses in the law that predated that. Starting in the 1920s, under the Fordney-McCumber Act of 1922, Congress actually allowed tariffs to be varied by the president under certain circumstances. and they'd spell out in the statute that often there had to be an investigation by an official tariff body. So the what used to be called the U.S. Tariff Commission would investigate if those parameters of the statute had been met, and if so, the president could move the rate up or down to respond to specific exigencies. So this was established in law, but notice that the parameters were set and spelled out by Congress. It wasn't Congress saying, Mr. President, you can regulate as you can choose. It was telling the president, you can vary the rates up to a certain degree if X, Y, and Z is met. And this had been discussed in a previous Supreme Court case. The last time the Supreme Court heard anything of this significance about tariffs was 1928. It's a case called J.W. Hampton versus the United
That's
States.
That's almost 100 years ago.
100 years ago. So nobody alive today remembers this case. We've read about it, and a very few number of people have studied it, but it had been considered kind of a distant settled law. And what J.W. Hampton said is that Congress may delegate its express powers if it provides a, quote, intelligible principle in the statute on what the president can do. And they did this on the tariff law, so they upheld the tariff law because the intelligible principle was there. And successive laws on tariffs have basically said this. They said Congress sets the tariff rate, but the president can vary it under circumstances X, Y, and Z. And IEEPA doesn't do any of that, so that's why there's a delegation problem.
And probably in those earlier cases, Congress was very sensitive about the point because Congress doesn't, generally speaking, want to give away its power to the president.
Right, right.
So therefore, it specifies with a certain degree of precision what and to what degree and how it's going to delegate its own powers. And the Founding Fathers and the Federalist Papers talked about the virtue of the structure and the way it, each branch is jealous of its own power, jealous of other powers. And so carefully guarding their own powers to prevent, to preserve the checks and balances seems like a longstanding American tradition, leading to what you just said, namely Congress, when it delegates, does so with precision.
Yes, yes. And most other trade statutes that have emerged since the 1930s have done this. So, for example, in 1962, President Kennedy signs a bill that overhauls the trade statutes, and it had several specific clauses that deal with what are referred to as discriminatory actions by other countries. So, for example, China behaves badly in the international arena, it does something that manipulates commerce, and we can debate the merits of those, but Congress has established authorities under that law when the president can make a determination that bad behavior is occurring and therefore retaliate. There are other laws that say if national security is invoked around a specific product, say it's useful for military purposes or weapons or something that's needed on that basis, the president can invoke tariffs, but he has to show that they meet a national security requirement. So all of these things are spelled out in law. But you get to IEEPA, it doesn't even contain the word tariff. It doesn't even specify or contemplate this circumstance. And Trump took that and said, well, I'm going to read into the vagaries of the text because it allows the regulation of commerce in emergencies. And this is intended for like sanctions on enemy countries that are behaving badly. If Iran is building a nuclear weapon, we can put sanctions on it under IEEPA. That was the original intent. And Trump's saying, well, if you can put sanctions on it, you can also put tariffs. And not only can you put tariffs, you can rewrite the entire tariff schedule of the United States, which is just astounding. Something that's spelled out in law, he's saying, well, no, I can just rewrite that by the executive order and sign a completely new rates of my own design that have never been passed by Congress and raise hundreds of billions of dollars in tax revenue from it, also never passed by Congress, and just call that, my new revenue.
Exploiting, it's not even exploiting the vagueness of the statute, is it? It's just attributing or imputing to the statute content that it doesn't contain.
That is exactly it. It's not even in the penumbra. It's imaginary, and he just asserted it in there. And this is why no other president prior to Trump had ever claimed this power. It's a novel legal theory that emerges in February and March of 2025 for the first time ever, and Trump takes it and he runs with it. But the only reason he gets away with it is because our court system moves very slowly in response to this. So he can carry out and impose an IEEPA tariff with the stroke of a pen and then change it the next day and change it the next week, is what he was essentially doing for the last year, whereas these court cases take weeks and months to move through the judicial system. And it basically took almost a year to get to this ruling that we got over the last week that basically struck it down.
Well, you know, that does make me think of some things that ordinary people who don't follow this all the time might really wonder. So like someone might, this is like a facetious question, but someone might wonder, well, why didn't the court just act the next day?
Right, right.
When,
yeah, and you know that they have to, there's a jockeying of judicial arguments that are made. There's a procedure. There's a process that plays out. The court is very attentive to, you know, did I give each side a fair hearing to make their arguments? There are motions and other motions on how the argument should proceed. And also in our judicial system, it doesn't immediately start at the Supreme Court. It usually goes into a lower court first, which is what happened here. They filed the case last April. It played out. It took about a month to turn over a decision, and this was in the U.S. Court of International Trade, a very obscure specialized court for these types of cases, and it rules against Trump, which, you know, if it wasn't a big controversial issue, that would be the end of it. The ruling was there about a month later, but the Trump administration appealed it, and it goes to the appellate court, and that takes a few months. The appellate court rules against Trump. Then they appeal again to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court moves very slowly. It schedules arguments. It has discussion. And finally, they issued their opinion, which is what we got last week.
In Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution, as I recall, it states that the judicial power of the United States extends to cases and controversies.
Yes.
So in other words, they can't even speak to a thing officially. Unless there's a case.
That's exactly it. They typically don't assert original jurisdiction at the Supreme Court.
Nor do they offer advisory opinions.
Right.
Which is
right.
Actually different from some other countries that have a Supreme or Chief Court of some kind. There are places where the Chief Court does offer advisory opinions before there's any case or controversy. But the judicial power here is actually very constrained constitutionally.
Yes.
It can't even act unless there's a case. And of course, the Supreme Court can't act on a case until it works its way up to the court.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a kind of deliberative quality to the process, which I think Americans should be proud of and pleased, because we don't get these snap decisions. That when it gets to the top court, it's been pretty thoroughly thought through. Although this was a pretty long think through. This was like 170 pages.
Yes, and probably in the several thousand pages when you get to all the briefs and amicus filings.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's been discussed at every conceivable angle for months by some of the top legal minds in the country. And almost every territory of this case has been explored to some degree. So when you see like the president posting on Truth Social that this is a poorly thought out decision, that's not really based in reality. This is an extremely conscientious decision. He just
right.
doesn't like the outcome.
Yeah, exactly. So regarding the outcome, back to the basics, six members of the court agreed that the IEEPA statute does not allow for presidential tariffs to be imposed. But among those six, there was a subset, as I understand it, of at least Roberts and Gorsuch and Barrett, who said that in addition to the fact that IEEPA doesn't cover tariffs, also, if it did, it would be in violation of what they call the major questions doctrine.
Right, right.
Explain that a little bit, please.
So the major questions doctrine is a principle that's emerged from judicial philosophy, and it's a way of summarizing. It says that Congress cannot basically give vagaries of statute over to the executive branch, and the executive branch cannot turn around and say, well, we're going to interpret issues of major significance, of political and economic significance, is usually the historical test that's been applied here, just by reading it into the text. In fact, Congress actually has to provide some pretty strict guidance here. And you may remember there were several cases on this in the last term. The most notable one pertained to EPA rules on environmental emissions, where in the past the EPA had interpreted from the vagaries of statute a very strong justification for some actions it was doing. And the court said, no, wait a minute, the Congress has not spoken to this yet.
Mm-hmm. And when it's a major question, the presumption is, as I understand it, that Congress does not give away its jurisdiction over major questions unless it does so very explicitly.
Right. And within, again, back to those narrow confines. So you often see it asserted in parallel with this non-delegation concept. And that's where some of the differences of judicial philosophy emerge. So you mentioned the three conservatives in the majority generally had various degrees of acceptance of the major questions doctrine. Although, you know, I think internally they have some philosophical nuances between them.
Like Barrett doesn't agree with Roberts entirely on the
exactly,
point.
Exactly. But she nods generally in the thrust of the same direction of reaching that decision. Whereas yet the three liberals on the court have been kind of skeptical of the major questions doctrine.
Which means that they have been sympathetic to major grants of power
exactly.
from the Congress to president.
Exactly. But at the same time, you know, the three liberal justices that sided with the majority on this, they did so through slightly different rationalizations. For example, they looked at the text of the statute and they saw it doesn't even say tariff. So it's like, this is a bridge too far. And because of that, you are able to piece together a majority where they generally arrive at the same decision, although through slightly different ways.
Yeah. There's some interesting legal technicalities there because, for example, if the major questions doctrine did apply here, it would be irrelevant if the statute itself doesn't authorize tariffs.
Basically,
if it did authorize tariffs, if the word tariff was in it, then maybe the major questions doctrine could have struck down IEEPA.
Right.
But it doesn't say that, so they didn't need to go there.
Yeah.
Is there any other reason why Kagan and Jackson and Sotomayor would be reluctant to agree on the major questions doctrine?
Well, because they've actually ruled differently in the past. So when several of the challenges under similar types of legal arguments were made against Joe Biden for executive overreach in, say, like environmental regulation, or, you know, there were other times when Biden tried to expansively interpret student loans forgiveness.
Oh, I remember that one.
Plenty of different cases where either portions of the liberal bloc or all three of them upheld generally exercises of presidential power. So, you know, that in that sense, they've kind of flipped to the other side on this particular case. Now, I can make a case that reading a tariff into IEEPA was just so egregiously across the line that they had no choice but
to couldn't flip. Go there.
Exactly. I mean, the others. I disagree with their dissents on the Joe Biden era cases, but one could argue that their judicial philosophy was consistently applied there. Whereas here you have just such an egregious assertion of presidential power where it did not exist that they had basically no choice but to strike it down.
Maybe on this question of major questions, maybe the three-person liberal group is hedging its bets. So that under a future Democratic president who wants to claim very expansive powers, regulatory, quasi-legislative powers in the service of, let's say, social justice.
Yes, right.
Then they'll be able to say, fine. Because remember, we never agreed that the major questions doctrine was a big deal.
So they see it less as like an all-encompassing rule and more as a line. And they can say, yeah, Trump's IEEPA tariffs crossed way over that line, but they say maybe another lesser exercise of this type of executive power doesn't cross that line. So they're trying to carve out a different strategy, is essentially what's happened.
So watch for that justification in a future year when a comparable kind of case, not on tariffs, comes up. After the ruling came out, I watched live President Trump's press conference from the White House. You may have done the same.
Oh, yes.
It was pretty wild. One of the, you know, more serious things that he said was that he praised Brett Kavanaugh. He was so proud of him, he said. and that Kavanaugh had identified all sorts of ways that, you know, he should have been able to do what he wanted to do. Right. And one of the things I think that Kavanaugh argued, and tell me if I've got this right, is that tariffs would have been okay and the major questions doctrine didn't apply because, after all, this is foreign affairs.
Right, right.
And, you know, a few moments ago, facetiously, I commented that many people say, well, he should be able to make those foreign countries pay. But the trouble with tariffs on that point is that when tariffs are imposed, foreign countries don't pay a dime.
Well, that's exactly it. You know, this has been a talking point of the Trump administration. So we're going to make foreign countries pay. But we know just as recently as about a week ago, the Federal Reserve of New York released a study that it questioned tariff incidences. Who bears the burden of this tax? And they found that the overwhelming majority of it falls on U.S. consumers and U.S. companies. And several other studies have looked into this. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of 90 to 95% of the burden of the tax falls on the United States. So it's not foreign countries that are paying.
It's Americans.
We are taxing our citizens for purchasing things that were originally built or made in a foreign country, but it's delivered here.
I mean, I suppose there may be presidential powers where a president could, like, assess a fine on a foreign country for some infraction. That wouldn't be paid by Americans. That would be paid by foreign. But this isn't that.
This is a substantial revenue generator. I mean, we're talking roughly $200 billion in the last year has been collected out of these tariffs. That's a major part of the U.S. federal budget.
Collected from Americans.
Right. So, I think, like, Justice Kavanaugh was giving a lot of generosity to the Trump administration's arguments. I'll be frank here. I don't think Kavanaugh understands the economics of it. I wouldn't expect most justices to. They're not economists. Although I would hope that our justices investigate questions like this. And then I think the second thing, and then you find this on the dissenting judges in the overall ruling. So there are three conservatives, Kavanaugh, Alito, and Thomas, who do dissent. And of course, Trump's praising them at the press conference. I think they're actually very confused in their jurisprudence. Because again, if you go back to that case, J.W. Hampton versus United States, that's the last major tariff case. It's not only a delegation case, it also defines the relationship between tax uses of tariffs and regulatory uses of tariffs.
That's the one that was 98 years ago.
Because that was the big question. It's like, are tariffs a tax or are they a regulation? And what the court basically comes up with an answer, the court says they're actually both at the same time. Because a tariff collects revenue and it also alters the market in an intended way with protection.
So it intrudes upon congressional jurisdiction in two ways.
Exactly. And if you look at the founding era documents, you go to something like James Madison. Madison recognized this. And he said that the tariff power is concurrently an exercise of this commerce power in foreign affairs and the tax power to raise revenue for the government. And of course, Donald Trump has been bragging and boasting and tweeting and commenting nonstop for the last year about all the revenue that's raised by this new tariff system he's imposed. He can't turn around and say, wait a minute, this isn't really a tax. That would be a self-contradiction, although he's tried to do that at various points.
I can't help but thinking back to the ACA case where Chief Justice Roberts said that the penalty that was assessed on people who didn't buy the insurance, it had been in the legislative history, it was stated it was not a tax.
Yes, yeah.
But Roberts decided that he would proclaim it to be a tax.
Exactly.
So that it could be justified under the clause.
Yeah, and Robert, there's another interesting thing, because Roberts took that stance in the Obamacare, the Sebelius case.
Yes.
And it was fairly notorious. He caught a lot of flack for that. He did so by invoking the authority of an earlier 1920s case, Bailey versus Drexel Furniture Company, which is the governing principle that determined the Hampton ruling in the tariff case.
They're related.
So they are directly related. And what it weirdly did, you know, this is a quirk of history. He probably never thought that he would be ruling on another tariff case. This had been settled 98 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And yet we get this weird tariff case that was completely unexpected, even like just over a year ago. Roberts, in order to preserve his reliance on Bailey versus Drexel, also effectively has to uphold that principle applied to tariffs, therefore tariffs are taxes.
Yeah. Wow. And yet he sets that aside in this case.
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing I want to comment on, it's in some ways painful to do so because I have admired Justice Thomas for many of his rulings over many years. He's the longest serving member of the court at this point. But I'm really having trouble understanding his reasoning and his dissent. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but it seems to me that his justification, his readiness to justify President Trump's flexibility in imputing to the law what the president wants is awfully reminiscent of the old doctrine that he objected to before, the living constitution. The living constitution says, well, the constitutional text, it means what's needed in the current moment is what it means. And has Justice Thomas become, in effect, a proponent of something like the living constitution?
Well, that was a sad part of this case. You know, Thomas was kind of the wild card. He didn't say much at the hearing. We didn't know exactly how he was going to rule on this. And he had a very strange dissent. I think it's actually the weakest legal argument I've ever read from him, period. And it was so weak, in fact, Justice Gorsuch wrote a concurrence where he quoted Justice Thomas's previous opinions to debunk Justice Thomas's dissent. And it's embarrassing. I felt bad for Thomas reading that because it's just clear as day. So I don't know what was going through Thomas's mind other than he actually did, I think, fall into this outcomes-based rationalization. He wanted Trump's policy to win, so he looked for a way to write it. And you know, Thomas has a reputation as a very careful, historically minded writer. The one thing that jumped out to me about his dissent, and I pointed this out in some of the things I've written on it. So Thomas tries to parse the text of the Constitution. The tax clause says duties, imposts, and excises. And Thomas had this very weird judicial history where he goes back to like acts of parliament before the Constitution and says that the king's use of a duty isn't really a tax. And it was it's just this very strange argument. And it looked, it was tendentious is probably the best way. And you read through this thing and he's saying, well, a duty's not a tax according to earlier legal precedent in the Acts of Parliament, it derives from the king. He was basically saying that the colonists would have accepted a duty proclaimed by the king, which is utter nonsense by the Revolution. I mean, this is the Boston Tea Party, which is what Gorsuch pointed out. He says it's hard to imagine the people at the Boston Tea Party accepting this tariff. But Thomas blurred his language because he misread the Constitution, which is in a very uncharacteristic way. You know, duties, imposts, and excises, I mentioned this earlier, these are very precise terms. They're 18th century synonyms for types of taxes. And although we talk about tariffs today as a duty, that's not accurate. The real term that authorizes the tariff is that second one, the least used one, the impost.
Yeah.
An impost is an 18th century word for tariff. And we know that from the law, but we also know it at the Constitutional Convention. One of the delegates stood up when that clause was read and says, he asked James Wilson, who's one of the major authors, explain what each of these terms mean. And Madison writes it down. And when he gets to impost, he says, oh, impost, that's basically a tariff. So Justice Thomas erred on something that was stated explicitly at the Constitutional Convention.
Yeah.
In a very uncharacteristic way, which tells me either he had a very sloppy clerk handed them this, or he was just not on his game.
Yeah, well, maybe the most gracious thing to do here is just like to turn the page on the Thomas dissent.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the future a little bit here. In his press conference afterwards, President Trump was pretty adamant about the fact, according to him, that actually he's still got a huge number of alternative bases on which he can impose the same tariffs he imposed under IEEPA. And he even said that the court's decision affirmed these various other legal authorities that he could have used, and now he's just going to switch to them.
Yeah.
So does President Trump, or any president, have a bunch of other legitimate legal authorities under which to impose all these tariffs?
Well, the question that anyone hears that should be asking is, if all these other legal authorities were stronger, why did he not use them? Why did he choose to use IEPA? And I think the obvious question is IEPA, at least his interpretation of it, was much more expansive than any of these other statutes. Now, yes, there are other statutes in U.S. tariff law that the court has generally affirmed historically because they meet that intelligible principle test. This is Section 201, Section 232, and Section 301 are the major examples of this. And they pertain to various cases of national security, that's Section 232. And then 201 and 301 are various types of discriminatory behavior, bad behavior by other countries that impede or threaten U.S. industries. And we could have a policy debate. I think most of those are misused when they're applied, but they've been sustained in court. And Trump, of course, yes, he says, I'm going to follow those. They're not new to Trump because in his first term, he used Section 301 tariffs against China on specific products. Why didn't he follow that route again? Well, because it's more cumbersome, it's more restrictive, it's more narrow and confined, and he thought he had invented a new power in IEPA.
So he was mistaken on that point.
Yes,
so now
yeah.
he's just flipping back to the other. He says that Section 122 of something, I don't know
right.
of what, Section 122 authorizes him to impose these new 10% and now 15% global tariffs.
Right.
Does it?
So Trump is engaged in what we refer to as statute shopping. And we know this historically. Joe Biden did this on the student loan forgiveness. He first claimed that one law authorized it. And when the Supreme Court struck him down, he went around and tried to find other laws. And for the rest of his term, it's just a succession of rulings against him. No, this law doesn't apply. No, this law doesn't apply. Well, what Trump has done, the Trade Act of 1974 established a tariff power, another of these delegated tariff powers called Section 122. And what Section 122 said is that the president may impose a tariff of up to 15% on all other countries for a maximum period of 150 days to deal with certain economic circumstances. And the most relevant one is what's referred to as a serious and severe and persistent balance of payments deficit.
Balance of payments deficit.
Yes. So Trump is looking on that and he's, aha. I'm going to just declare another balance of payments deficit problem, and I'm going to enact 15% tariffs for the next 150 days.
And that's 150 days is as much as he can do without,
because otherwise it has to be approved by Congress. It's that's the parameter, one of the parameters on the statute. So he signed a new order that I think it takes effect on February 24th, and 150 days from there, there's supposedly we are going to have 15% tariffs now.
But is there a balance of payments crisis?
No, that's the problem. There is no balance of payments deficit. You can go to the accounting books of the United States right now. The balance of payments deficit is zero. There are components of the balance of payment that he is conflating the language with.
Subcomponents.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay.
So Trump is saying balance of payments deficit really means a trade deficit or a current account deficit. So a trade deficit is we are importing more goods and services than we export. And that's true.
That's a trade deficit.
That's a basic trade deficit. But remember, people don't send us imports for free. We actually have to send money abroad for them. And the balance of payments itself, it's a much broader accounting of everything that crosses the border in terms of financial transactions. So it does have the current account, the goods and services component in there, but it also has two other components, the capital account and the financial account. And those are capital account, that's payments abroad. That are made. So transfer capital, financial account. There's some investing components. It's a very complex list of accounting terms on the balance sheet. And the gist of it is, if you add them all up together, the current account deficit is almost exactly offset by the capital account surplus. So it comes out to zero.
So it isn't really the basis for invoking Section 122 of the 74 Act.
That is exactly it. And so, you know, people may be asking, why does Section 122 exist? Well,
it made sense at the time because we were still pegged to the gold. Right,
right. It's at the very tail end. So go back to the monetary history. Remember, Richard Nixon very notoriously severs the link between the gold and the dollar. The last of many such steps. FDR started it in the 1930s. But in 1971, we had what was referred to as the Nixon shock. And that is, he had recognized that there was a drawdown crisis occurring because all other countries that were part of the Bretton Woods system had pegged their currency to the dollar. And part of the deal of the peg is that they can convert dollar holdings at, I think it was $35 per ounce for gold with the United States. They used to be able to. And countries figured this out. And then in times of, especially in the 1960s, it started to really elevate and take off. They were like, aha, we'll take our dollars to the gold window. And they just start drawing down on Fort Knox is essentially what happened. So Nixon put a stop to that and severing the link. And what's interesting is in the Bretton Woods era, in the fixed exchange rate system, you could technically have what was referred to as a balance of payments deficit. What that meant is that the official reserves of the United States were being drawn down upon relative to their previous position the year before.
Once those reserves were no longer connected to the dollar, but the dollar was allowed to float freely.
Exactly.
it became moot.
Exactly. So it moots the question. And Nixon, remember, he severs this link in 1971, but he tries to reestablish the currency peg in several actions. So a little bit later, December 71, he has the Smithsonian Agreement, which is an attempt to reestablish the currency peg. And that lasts for a little over a year, but then he finds out that gold is appreciating in price relative to the dollar, so he has to force a dollar devaluation in early 1973, and Europe and Japan look at him and say, well, you're not going to honor this, we're gone. We're going to let our currencies float.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens, April 1973, Nixon goes to Congress and he says, you need to give me these new tools, one of which is to address a balance of payments deficit. And that is, give me a tariff tool that I can use as leverage. And he's essentially saying, we're going to try to reestablish the peg.
Thus, Section 122
Thus, Section 122, that's where it comes from. And
now that the dollar is floating, balance of payments deficits essentially are defined out of existence.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Milton Friedman points this out. There's an article he wrote in 1967, and he says, look, under a fixed exchange rate, you could have balance of payment deficits, or really they're drawdowns on the official reserve accounts occurring because those official reserves are not determined by any market mechanism. They're determined by central bankers,
right,
who are basically guessing, is like, this is how much we must have in our account to preserve the peg at this level. And the Central Bank of the United States will coordinate with the Central Bank of France to make sure that the balances are within a target range.
So I think we're getting into a little arcane level of detail.
It is very arcane.
But I think the point is that now that these new tariffs have been implemented by the president, some company or American citizen who's entitled to contest the tariffs that he's being forced to pay will have to bring a case that he shouldn't have to pay these tariffs.
Yeah, yeah.
And once that case gets going through the court system, it will eventually work its way through the appellate courts, et cetera, up to the Supreme Court. And at that point, all the allegedly arcane details that you and I have just been discussing
exactly
in the last 30 seconds or 45 seconds is going to be front and center of the U.S. Supreme Court's deliberation. Is there or isn't there a balance of payments deficit?
That's exactly it.
The knowledge, you're going to have to come and testify as an expert witness, Phil.
That's the wildness of it. I mean, this is deep tariff history. There are very few economists alive today that deal with this period because it was obsolete.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So, yeah, we're back in some what was old is new again. Measurements that the Commerce Department ceased tracking in the 1970s are now going to be determinative of the outcome.
Good grief!
It's probably guaranteed there's going to be another lawsuit.
Yep.
It'll go through the process. The interesting thing here is what will the lower courts do? Are they going to defer to the executive branch like they did in the IEPA case and say,
yeah,
yes, we're going to rule, but we'll rule, stay a ruling until...
They stayed. Everything got stayed until the end.
What's interesting here, it'll be curious to see if they do that again or if their patience with the Trump administration is worn out.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be the case that their patience is worn out. And I'll cite one example of this, which I think is very pertinent on Section 122. Because even though Trump is now claiming, I have this other authority under Section 122 to proceed with a balance of payments deficit tariff, even though it doesn't exist, Trump, when he was arguing the last case, when it went before the appellate court, they filed all these briefs. And one of the questions was, why are you using IEPA? Why not any of these other areas of statutes?
Uh-oh, did they say the wrong thing?
And they sure did say the wrong thing. The Solicitor General, on the first appeal of this case, filed a brief that said, well, Section 122 doesn't apply to what we are trying to do here. Therefore, we cannot use it because there's no current accounts deficit that's conceptually different from a trade deficit.
Oh boy.
So he put this in writing.
So that's in writing. It hasn't been canceled or erased or deleted.
Exactly. Okay. It's filed with the court. And, you know, if I were a judge on one of these lower district courts, or really the Court of International Trade, and someone showed me that and said, wait a minute, the argument you made 6 months ago, now you're saying the exact opposite. You aren't really making an argument based in fact. I would be less inclined to give him deference on
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. We're kind of at the end of this, Phil, but I wanted just to come back to something I said at the beginning. You kind of were one of the very small handful of people who got the ball rolling on what turned out to be this case that the Supreme Court has just ruled on. How did you get the ball rolling on this? When did you notice the problem and what did you do?
Well, I was one of the first people kind of sounding the alarm bells back in February when Trump started hinting he was going to use something like IEPA to impose tariffs. And, you know, people at the time thought, oh, no, that's way too risky of a route. He's going to have milder tariffs under Section 301 because they'd be sustained in court. And then I'm like, no, wait a minute. Some of the things he's saying sound like IEPA tariffs. And, I started raising the alarm bells among kind of the free market side of the world, including friends that operate in our space that work on trade economics. And we're like, well, what if he does this? What are we going to do? And then back in April, Trump finally pulled the trigger on this, the Liberation Day press conference.
Yeah, so-called. Mm-hmm.
And I was together at an economics conference with several colleagues who were of this free trade network, essentially. And we decided, we needed to issue a statement of some sort on this.
So you wrote a statement up. It became an anti-tariff declaration.
That is exactly it. And we laid out in very plain language, here's the case for free trade. Here are the legal arguments that are problems with what Trump is doing. Here's the constitutional history. Here's
you
the American
founding. The founding fathers.
Exactly. And it was
We put it up on the independentinstitute.org website, and it has its own website as well, antitariff.org, I think we called it. And how many signatories did you get, and who were they?
It was a massive amount. So the initial, I'd say the core 30 or so, we had several Nobel Prize winners, three Nobel Prize winners. We had former officials with the Council of Economic Advisors, some very distinguished, well-known economists, former U.S. Senator Phil Graham, for example, signed it. And then we released it out into the wild, and then over the course of several weeks, we get hundreds upon hundreds of other signers, including some top experts in this field, that are all saying, "Wait a minute, there's a problem here, Mr. Trump. What you are doing here, it's not legal and it's not good economics." So it was really one of the first coherent statements to systematically oppose the legal claims that were being made behind IEPA for the administration.
And then that drew the attention of other people who were concerned in the case, including, I think, the lead attorney.
Ilya Solman, who's a friend, was one of the signers of our original statement. And he is the person who filed that first lawsuit, the VOS Selections lawsuit that went all the way to the Supreme Court and won. Along the way, so he files the initial version of the lawsuit. And it's in the low-level U.S. Court of International Trade. As it starts to gain attention, you got some very high-profile attorneys from across the political spectrum are basically volunteering and say, we want to join your case. And that took it all the way to the Supreme Court from there. So he ended up with Neil Katyal, who was former President Obama's Solicitor General. We had several conservative legal scholars also helped on it. You know, like Richard Epstein wrote some material. Very prominent conservative and liberal leaning legal scholars basically said, you know, we're going to we may disagree on our politics, but this is crossing the line to infer this tariff power.
Right.
So it was a real all-star team of lawyers that built up behind this case. And then, of course, along the way, I was involved on helping some of the amicus brief writers on some of their ideas. I had also done some research on the tariff history elements of what went into this. And
our organization, the Independent Institute, was a co-sponsor of one of the more important amicus briefs that was filed with the court, and you helped write it.
The brief in particular focused on the constitutional era history, the Federalist Papers and James Madison, and what the debates were saying about this power and could it be delegated. And it ends up being cited in the appellate ruling. So this was the we co-signed onto the AAF brief, which was former Vice President Mike Pence had spearheaded getting the legal team behind that. And it ends up, it's cited as one of the more important points
by the Court of International Trade.
By the appellate court.
The appellate court. Mm-hmm.
So it's what boosts it up into the Supreme Court. It's one of the major factors there. And then, of course, we were involved in crafting some of the arguments and doing the economic analysis as the Supreme Court case is playing out. So I did several briefings down on Capitol Hill with the AAF team and with the legal team that was involved in filing the case.
Mm-hmm. Just to be clear, it is logically possible, am I right? I think it's logically possible for someone to be in favor of tariffs as an allegedly good policy, but to oppose the willy-nilly use of IEEPA and other statutes to impose them. Even though I think tariffs are probably mostly a bad idea most of the time.
They tend to be bad economic policy.
But aside from bad economic policy, there was no constitutional justification for the power exercised, right?
That is exactly. I mean, the Constitution says tariffs are a power of Congress. We should have that debate in Congress, and Congress needs to vote on it. And it's as simple as that.
I'm pretty darn proud of the Independent Institute and, of course, of you as my colleague for taking the lead and having such a big impact on the development of this tariff case. I'm going to informally call you Tariff Slayer Man.
Here we go. I will happily accept that label.
Okay, good. And I want to thank you for all the work you've done and probably are going to have to continue doing since this issue is going to roll its way back toward us again. Thank you for all your hard work, and let me thank all of our friends who join us on these recordings and these podcast sessions. Thanks for tuning into Independent Conversations. Keep in mind that you can keep up with the latest by going to our website, independent.org, where there are a number of really important essays written by my colleague, Phil Magnus, when you can read them fresh as soon as we post them to our website, independent.org. Okay, thank you again, Phil.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. Take care, everybody, and come back again to Independent Conversations.